You're listening to Weird and Dead, the paleontology podcast that tells evolution's most embarrassing and bizarre stories. I'm Amy Atwater.
And I'm Megan Wetherell, and we're two living scientists who are weirdly excited about dead things.
In this episode, we get way too excited about dead things as they were dying because we're talking about signs of illnesses and injury in fossil animals.
We're going to talk about dinosaur cancer, the logistics of getting fucked up hard enough to leave a mark on your bone, and the nasty, pus-filled consequences of surviving an animal bite.
Like always, our podcast talks about some disgusting stuff, so please read through the content warnings before continuing. This is going to be an interesting episode, as I know how gross it's going to be. So just be fully prepared. And to start, we're going to talk about one of the organisms that introduced me to this topic of being able to see injury, disease, all these problems in the bone. And that is arguably probably the most famous case of paleopathology in the fossil record for dinosaurs, at least. And that would be Big Al, the Allosaurus, who is really famous because they made...
Can I tell you really quick? I've been thinking that Al was a T-Rex this whole time. I forgot that he was an Allosaurus. But that's why I didn't do that research project. I was like, oh yeah, Al, that T-Rex that had all those problems.
Oh, from afar, their skulls look meh, pretty close. I mean, I know they don't, nerds. I know they're not. And
up close, they look the fucking same to me.
Exactly. Yeah. Our logo at work has an Allosaurus on it, and people call it a T-Rex all the time. And I'm like, well, yeah, duh. It's not that surprising. So I don't expect the general public to even know these dinosaurs' names necessarily. So this is about Big Al, the Allosaurus. This is a specimen that I used to manage, I suppose, as the paleo collection manager at Museum of the Rockies. That's where Big Al lives. It is a 95% complete Allosaurus specimen from Wyoming. Wow. It got its own TV show. It's doing way better than us, Megan. And it's been dead for 145 million years.
It's because it's got a white man's name.
And was found and published on and celebrated by exactly those folks and us and everyone else. We all get inspired by dinosaurs. And so there was the Ballad of Big Al. I always just like hear that Paul Simon song, You Can Call Me Al. That's always what I think about when I hear Big Al. Anyway, it is a really cool fossil because it's 95 fucking percent complete. Like, that's insane. Like, that is in paleo world. Yeah. That's pretty great for a large animal. That's great. And then what's really spectacular about it is that this poor, poor dinosaur shows signs of 19 different pathologies. So pathologies meaning, as we will get into, injuries, signs
of collecting
disease.
Illnesses.
Yeah, exactly. literally like a Girl Scout badge. They were just like, one here, one there. So all of the different places that this dinosaur had injuries, where they also showed signs of, well, healing while also getting much worse. Mm. So this animal lived through these experiences. They did not all happen at once. It really was like a obstacle course of hell. It has injuries to its ribs, its gastralia, which is its tummy ribs. They're cute. We got the vertebrae that are messed up, are the dorsal, so the back ones, the neck ones, the tail ones, chevrons, which are the cute little part that hang off of a tail, scapula, so one of the shoulder blades got messed up. Part of the claw on one of the hands shows signs of it would have been really ouchy to attack with. We also have injuries to the hips. And then the ones that really stick in my brain the most are the ones on the metatarsals and the phalanges of the foot. They are really, really, really intense. I only have two pictures this episode. I did good. So you can go ahead and scroll down.
That looks like a rib that's like shoved through a donut of what I'm assuming is bone.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Yep.
Donut bone.
That's the messed up rib, which was described as like having a giant hole of pus, which is probably the first of many times you're going to hear that word this episode. Just buckle up, y'all. And then the one that really makes me cringe is the one of its foot. So that's the second picture I have for you.
Oh, buddy. That looks like a crinoid.
Yeah, that does. Looks like
pierced a crinoid.
Which one's the anal chimney? I think it's the fucked up metatarsal.
Dealer's choice, really. Yeah, that's an unpleasant growth to have encircling your toe.
So what I love about this image is that you can see a healthy example of what this bone should look like on the other fingers, toes, I should say.
Yeah.
And you can just have this example. So it's the middle one that's got this huge, like, it just looks like it's got a pinata in the middle of it. And the other sides are normal and not crazy infected to the same degree, to really show you that this would have been, I mean, this would have been debilitating. This would have most definitely affected your ability to hunt and protect yourself. While it obviously didn't kill this dinosaur right off the bat because of this excess gnarly bone growth from the infection, it eventually is one of the contributing factors. And that's what the Ballad of Big Al is all about. It's all about these terrible things that happened to this juvenile Allosaurus. It starts with it essentially like, oh, like a hatchling, yay. Then it gets bigger and it's trying to hunt, and then this Diplodocus whacks it with its neck or something like that and like messes up, I don't know, like its vertebra and whatnot. And then it tries to hit on a older lady and she does not like it, and she bitch slaps him and breaks all of his ribs. And then later he trips while he's hunting and breaks his toe. I mean, it's like very dramatic. So I've never actually watched it. I'm just reading the Wikipedia like summary.
That's a lot of main character energy from
yeah, they describe it in the paper. It's a great paper from 2002 looking at it. And yeah, on a lot of the parts, like the specifically that rib I showed you and that messed up toe bone would have had a fistula with it, which was an opening on the skin for pus discharge. And that is the type of stuff I've been reading about. So please explain some of these concepts, these definitions, and why we're talking about this disgustingness today.
Yeah, so paleopathology is just kind of the study of all of the terrible shit that could have possibly happened to you before you became a fossil. Mm. And we're going to be talking a lot about antemortem stuff today. So there's antemortem, which is before death, perimortem, which is around death and is frequently, this is what you died from, and postmortem, which is stuff that happened to you after you died. Maybe you got eaten by something, maybe you got gnawed on. And we're mostly going to be talking about stuff that happened to you before you died, because that's the only way that you can develop these features. It's not that Al got a bone infection and passed away immediately. Sadly for Al suffered for a long time. So a lot of the animals we're talking about today, they had to actually suffer, because the things that we're looking at are your bone attempting to deal with an infection, to deal with an injury, to heal itself. And it's not always successful. And if it was fully successful, we wouldn't see that thing before you died. So we're talking about antemortem stuff here today. So we're not talking about, like, I mean, maybe you'll talk a little bit about it, but we're not really talking about, like, oh, bite marks and predation and all of that stuff. Like, we're mostly going to be talking about, we're going to talk about that a little, but, you know, dying doesn't produce pus. And that's really the topic of today's episode.
That was the qualifier. We discussed this. It was like, what are the parameters of this, of all the injuries? Only the ones that are pus producing. Mm, yes.
Yeah. Our tentative title listed here is either paleo pus or paleopathology and gross pus bones. Pyogenic, by the way, is the official Latin term for produces pus. And so pretty much most of what we're talking about today is something that produces pus. So when you are looking at paleopathology, regardless of what sort of injury or illness you're looking at, the basic idea is that bone is either added or bone is removed. And that can look like bone is moving, right? Like if you get scraped and healed, you're gonna develop like ridges, but that's not bone being moved. That is bone remodeling itself and bone like being added basically after you've had bone injury. So all forms of paleopathology that we're talking about today are some form of the bone is being added or the bone is being removed for one reason or another. And that is how you can tell that it's not healthy bone. Because healthy bone has an expected amount of bone. You can look at the other toes on Al's feet and you can see smooth outside bone where there should be smooth bone, rough bone where there should be muscle attachments. But there's usually the easiest way to tell that something is healthy is by looking at other members of its species, because that's how you cross compare, right? Otherwise, you might do what some early paleontologists did and assume that some of the grossness that we're going to talk about with Oreodonts, for example, was species distinct. So turns out that some early paleontologists in like the 40s and 50s looked at some very sick Oreodonts and thought each one was a different species because of its different degree of sickness. The easiest way to tell that that's not the case and that you're actually looking at disease is to cross-compare individuals, especially if they're coming from the same formation. That's a really nice, easy way to look at them. But bone, healthy bone, also kind of has like a pretty consistent look to it, I would say.
I know it when I see it.
It's usually pretty smooth. You know it when you see it. Yeah, so healthy bone typically has, at least in mammals, I'm sure other animals have this too, but I don't care about them, so whatever. You can decide if it does or does not happen in a dinosaur. But the inside of the bone, you'll have some hollow spaces if it's like your long bone. But like if you took your leg bone, you'd have a little bit of a hollow space, but a lot of like, it's called spongy bone because it really does look like a sponge that's inside your bone. It's also called trabecular bone. And then on the outside, you have a really, really hard layer of like thickened, smooth bone that doesn't have a lot of pockmarks in it. And that's the cortical bone. But the very outside of that can have small attachments for like tendons. It can have places where blood vessels are going in and out. It can have foramina, which is a big hole where nerves go through. So in order to identify healthy bone versus unhealthy bone, you can't just look at something and say, there's a hole in it. Clearly this animal was sick. That would be like looking at a skull and being like, there's two big holes right here in front of the nose. Clearly that animal is dying when really those are eye sockets, right? So you do have to kind of cross compare these things. Yeah. There's a lot of different ways that the bone can be impacted, right? So with Big Al, it sounds like there was some trauma involved.
Right. It's considered to be injuries for some of them. However, the paper does go into probably what you're about to talk about, which is like, you know, injuries versus like infections or illnesses. And then there's a whole category of idiopathic, of we don't really know, but it's fucked up.
Yeah. So illness, injuries, as my doctors keep informing me in a way that I think is frankly very rude, age can also impact your bones. Yes. I have a few bone spurs and apparently those are not signs of illness. They're just me getting older than my doctors, which is a little unsettling.
Yeah.
And the other thing is that it's not just illness and injury, because two people exposed to the same illness, like two people who get arthritis, will not have the exact same reaction. So there are actually some things that make the immune response, for example, cause remodeling of the bone. So cause your body to take that calcium and maybe add some more bone, maybe remove bone, but your body is actually doing that. It's not like it's been scratched away by arthritis. It's not like arthritis is a disease that just tosses bone at you. Arthritis is something where your body's immune response is adding on chunks of bone. So can you guess, Amy, what are some of the things that would make you more likely to have an immune response?
A stronger immune mm-hmm. response? I'm on the spot and I'm nervous.
Well, you are one of them. So that
being a woman, I know that we have more autoimmune diseases. I have psoriasis and there's psoriatic arthritis mm-hmm. that I have to look forward to. But yeah, so stress, having a uterus, mm-hmm. being alive.
Stress, having a uterus, what goes into that uterus?
Yeah. Oh, having children.
Babies, usually.
Oh my God, wait, is that going to make it worse?
Yeah. So being pregnant will change your immune response, right?
Right.
That's why pregnant women have to be really careful.
Right.
Yeah, you have to be careful about like the things you're exposed to.
Fetus as an alien in your own body. Yes.
Yeah, you don't want your immune system to attack your fetus. This is how my sister got cat scratch fever when she was pregnant. The thing that you don't usually actually catch, but you can when your body's trying not to kill the embryo that's inside of you. Women typically have a stronger immune response, which could mean that if a woman and a man were exposed to something that would cause arthritis, because some arthritis is just age, some arthritis is actually caused by diseases. It's called reactive arthritis. And then, of course, there's things like psoriatic arthritis and rheumatoid arthritis, which are autoimmune diseases.
Yes, yeah.
But if you took a man and a woman, the woman's body would react more strongly, potentially giving her more signs of arthritis, potentially doing things like healing it faster if it is something like reactive arthritis.
Okay, so
like
you're trying to tell me syphilis, there's something a little bit okay? Because I was like, this episode already is disgusting, and now you're bumming me out about my...
Now I'm bumming you out.
Being female.
So your immune response is faster, but like that also, I think, technically means that your healing response, if that immune response is ever decreased, should also be faster, right? So you might get worse bone growths, Amy, but as long as you cure your syphilis afterwards, you'll be fine.
Oh, God, let me fucking email my doctor real quick.
Right, this is a little different. Oh, it also depends on the bone that is injured. Okay. So a lot of what I'm going to talk about today is osteomyelitis, which is bone infection. And bone infection, it often has kind of this characteristic response where the soft outer wrapping around your bone, because your bones come shrink-wrapped in something called periosteum. The periosteum, which also deposits something disgusting called bone bark, but periosteum is not on every single bone. So like your sesamoid bones, so your knees don't have periosteum, so they respond differently to infection. The cartilage, like ends of your bones, often don't have periosteum. So if you got like bone infection in your knee joint, your body would behave differently than if you got bone infection in your shin. All of this is to say, depending on your gender, depending on your level of illness, depending on your nutritional status, depending on where the injury occurs, you can have all of these different levels of reactions. So this stuff can look really different. And it also looks really different between things like mammals and reptiles and mammals and amphibians. That said, there are some kind of consistent markers for different ones. So some of them you can identify and say, I know exactly what that is. That is rickets, or that is probably tuberculosis.
Rickets.
But others you can't necessarily identify as clearly. I know. That is going to be really another theme of today. Is us laughing at the misery of animals and people. So yeah, I'm glad at least that most of my stuff is happening to adults, so I don't have to coo over dead injured babies again. The bright side.
Welcome
right?
to the show, everybody.
Regardless of what sort of thing is impacting your bones, and that can be things like tuberculosis, osteomyelitis, it can be cancers, it can be syphilis, tuberculosis. I already said tuberculosis. Tuberculosis is going to come up a lot today. Apparently it's like very common going back through the fossil 24. Record. Yeah. And of course, fractures, getting your bone broken or even bruised can show up on your bone, but only if that thing doesn't kill you right away. Because all of the things we're talking about are not lethal. And in fact, many of them actually don't impede your ability as a species to reproduce. So you mentioned looking at Al's toe, that looked really painful. And I agree. I don't think that is going to fall into the didn't affect Al's life at all.
Just his loneliness.
That said, just his loneliness. There are quite a few different things like Megan's bone spurs that are apparently, they're not necessarily going to cause pain, especially if they don't occur in the periosteum. The periosteum is the thing that has nerves. So if they occur on like a sesamoid bone, you might not necessarily be able to feel it. Sometimes you can have things like neuropathic arthritis where it damages your nerve so badly that you can't feel it. Which does make your arthritis significantly worse because you just grate your bones against one another.
I don't.
Yeah. And in the case of some animals, it's like a pattern, not just like random one-off. So a great example would be rhinoceroses. Yeah. Our friend Kelsey Stilson did a huge project on not just arthritis, but on lots of different types of paleopathologies in the toes of different species of rhinos and cross compared that to their body mass and found that, first off, lots of rhinos have arthritis. That does not mean that those rhinos were suffering or that those rhinos were dying, but lots and lots of rhinos, even baby rhinos, can sometimes have arthritis.
Wild.
Yeah. As these animals get bigger the rhino species, the worse the paleopathology is. And yet rhinos, at least until we hunt the rest of them, are still around.
Right, right, right.
Right? Like there's been plenty of rhinos that have survived.
They're still doing it.
So
still making
these things
arthritic
are not necessarily,
babies, you know.
Yeah. Still making arthritic babies. A lot of these things that we're going to talk about are obvious. And if it's super obvious, chances are it was probably pretty obvious to the animal as well. But a lot of them are potentially not as obvious to the animal, and they might not have necessarily suffered either. So not all of the things we're talking about are lethal, or at least not at first. So cancer?
That one tends to be pretty lethal. And it's also with you, as you're talking about all that, I'm thinking some of the stuff I'm going to tell you about mummies and cancerous tumors and mummies, it does seem like maybe in those cases they, you know, didn't know that that's what was causing their death or anything like that, especially because since they're mummies, there's some soft tissue. So it's not just relying on the bones to like define that. And I have taken an interesting dive today. I've been like really fascinated and then like really bummed out reading about cancer in deep time. But we do have cases of cancer from quite literally hundreds of millions of years ago. Okay. Yeah. And then I've also realized that within the cancer realm, it's all about a presence of tumors. However, they are they stressed many times that if it's a benign tumor, that's not cancerous. So being able to define if it's benign or malignant in a fossil is wild. So that's what some of I don't understand the medical terminology and whatnot, but it's been looking at CT scans and being able to study them. This really cool paper I read about the oldest case of cancer in a Triassic fossil is research that was done by, I'm a big fan of Yara Haridi, and it's a project that she was working on when she was in Berlin. That's right. Anyway, so we have this stem turtle that's 240 million years old with a leg bone that does show it's a malignant tumor and that it really is, oh gosh, it looks also, you know, again, looks painful in its own ways, but it is, they said that it looks almost exactly like osteosarcoma in humans, and that is not a super common cancer necessarily, but it is one that affects the bones, starts in the bones, but then can spread to organs as well. So it's bad news, really bad news. I really liked that Yara's work is showing and just articulating how it's important to study these diseases in deep time to understand how the diseases themselves change too, and how your immune system has evolved over time too. So to be able to positively identify cancerous tumors in the fossil record, which is just mind-blowing in a lot of ways. I read this other paper that they've been identified in mosasaurs, hadrosaurs, mammoths, and then there's also evidence of also osteosarcoma in a hominin fossil. It's in the foot of a hominin from South Africa, and it's 1.7 million years old, and it's the oldest case of confirmed cancer in a hominin, so human, a very close relative of ours. This site has been known to produce, I think, Homo ergaster and Paranthropus boisei. So it's probably from one of those. And again, it's an ankle bone. It's a metatarsal. And it's got this big, gnarly looking cancerous growth on the bone there. So it's been, and the interesting thing that this and the mummies article went into is, you know, when the max lifespan for a human is, you know, like maybe 30 years, it makes it that much more rare to find cancer, which, as you said, with, you know, diseases and just shitty stuff to your skeleton in general happens more when you get old. And so it's really, really rare to find them in mummies. But I read this really interesting paper about finding cancer mummies, essentially. And I was like, wow, that's interesting. This is really sad. And then I kept reading. And guys, I just have to apologize. I can't help it. The first case is that of a Roman period mummy belonging to an adult male who displayed abnormal tissue mass in the rectum. Next one. As the Renaissance king, a tumor mass was identified in the rectum. Next one, a bowel loop of feces. I was like,
Get your colon checked. colon cancer is way more serious than we are going to pretend it is here. Yeah, I guess when you have soft tissue, you can find and that non-really cancers right, as
so
well.
So again, those ones are affecting soft tissue. So we'd have no, unless it spreads or started elsewhere and then got to soft tissue, we wouldn't necessarily know. So a very interesting approach with mummies. And I didn't read a whole lot more about it, except, wow, I do, you know, guys, colon cancer, rectal stuff is on the rise for our generation. So eat your greens and go to the doctor and hope that your fossilized mummy skeleton isn't like full of cancer poop like 10,000 years from now. So just an idea. But you do you. I'm sorry. I feel really conflicted about laughing about butt cancer. But
also, if you see like a certain degree of illness, there's this tendency to like think of it as like a pandemic, like it's impacting so many other individuals. And that doesn't necessarily end up being true. You have to take into consideration the fact that the fossil record like is compacted time, right? Like these animals often didn't actually live together. Also that there's illnesses out there that just are not leaving a fossil record. It's not that dinosaurs never got butt cancer.
Well, no.
It's that we sadly do not have a lot of preserved butts.
We're working hard to change that. Yeah. I don't know where I'm going with that, but I like this idea.
I don't either. Amy Badley is looking into fossilizing her own asshole. That's what I'm hearing.
A dream of dreams that if we ever were able to give back and create some sort of scholarship, that it would be for inherently weird science and be like, I'm sorry. You have to be persuasive enough to tell us like why it matters, but why it's fucking hilarious. Mm.
And I don't really care if it matters. I care if it's funny.
Largely.
That's an interesting story. Cool. All right. So that's cancer as a broad topic. I'm noticing here on our notes, I again have called this T-Rex stuff and then specifically listed an animal that is not a T-Rex. So I really thought Big Al was a T-Rex.
We live closer to T-Rex than we do than T-Rex did to Allosaurus. So. You do have to.
I don't like that. That's dinosaurs are dumb and they look the same.
That's how they feel about us, except for we would, if a dinosaur saw us, they would be like, what weird, hairless, ginormous, baby-faced, bipedal ape is in my way? Except for we're not, anyway, never mind. This whole, dinosaurs. So when we talk about pathology, we can't, I know you said we weren't going to talk a ton about this, and I'm going to talk about it, which is all about like violence and fighting and the signs that we see of that.
I guess I have a little, so, you know, I'm talking
that's
about
true.
It too.
You do. I know a little bit of where you might be going. So this one is more about, well, okay, so like T-Rex, for example, right? So there is an idea out there by one particular very vocal, famous paleontologist that T-Rex was an obligate scavenger, all right? Mm-hmm. So that T-Rex was just not hunting anything, but just scavenging for all of its food. And a lot of people think this is total bullshit because it is.
Yeah.
So it's really fun to see papers come out that just are and more lines of evidence that point out that this is, you know, like I just don't know too many giant apex predators who wouldn't also be, you know, a lot of animals do a lot of all, right? Bears are going to be both scavengers and hunters. Bald eagles are both scavengers and hunters. Seems like, why can't it be both? Why can't we just accept that it was fucking T-Rex? It did whatever it wanted. Some days it felt like trying to eat some Edmontosaurus. And that is, we have a couple specimens that have, I saw one in Montana that was a healed bite wound in an Edmontosaurus, so a big-ass duck-billed dinosaur. It was antemortem, so it happened before, and we know it because there were signs of healing, so it obviously like did not die from that. And for the bite mark of that size for the Hell Creek Formation, the only predator large enough that we know of, maybe there was some giant Bigfoot of the Hell Creek out there.
It's like saber fang Sasquatch.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I'm with like scales. Yeah. I'm here for, or, you know, feathers. I'm down for that too. However, like, you know, the simplest explanation is that that Hadrosaur got bit by a T-Rex and it healed. It didn't kill the T-Rex. I mean, or the Hadrosaur. Then there is another publication that came out. I don't know when exactly, but in the last like 10 years or so, that's a T-Rex tooth crown that's actually stuck in a tailbone. It's in one of the caudal vertebra. Ooh. So a T-Rex tooth in an Edmontosaurus tailbone. And it too did not, it showed signs of healing. It was not, it didn't finish it off. And then there's also an Edmontosaurus again. They had to deal with T-Rex a lot at DMNS. So the Denver Museum of Nature and Science here in Colorado, there's a mounted Edmontosaurus that looks like it kind of has like a bite out of its tail. And it's hypothesized that this was probably T-Rex. And it too, I'm pretty sure, shows signs of healing. However, like there is the response to this is, well, doesn't show signs that T-Rex hunted necessarily, but that it did bite a T-Rex or an Edmontosaurus. Yeah. Like it doesn't prove that T-Rex was 100% a...
It could have been knocked off by another T-Rex. It could have just had a loose tooth for the day.
It could have just fallen. And T-Rex is so tall that it like got embedded in the bone. I mean, as it fell from gravity. I mean, you know that
the arms can... They could only bench press 400 pounds, so it cannot get back up.
It was like, it just, right, it was like a toe. Around. The Montesaurus was just like, okay, bite on. I'll get you out of here, little buddy.
Yeah, that's true. Maybe it was like the Land Before Time, but
isn't that like the mouse vicious. And the lion? It's like that kind of fable or whatever. Yeah. You know, the hater's gonna hate. I stand by what I said in the first place, which is I think T-Rex would have been just a totally going for whatever was easiest and most optimal and, you know, most available at the time, whether that was eating them or it, also we have a ton of evidence that T-Rex ate other T-Rex. And so, I mean, again, I guess that could have been scavenging. God, that's grim. But we do have T-Rex toe bones with T-Rex bite marks in them. So we do know that there was an eating of their own going on. But it does seem that T-Rex preferred, you know, or at least a lot of evidence with bite marks and stuff and in Edmontosaurus. And then, of course, Triceratops, which shows that it was the frill likely of Triceratops likely evolved to be a defense thing, not necessarily for showing off or social display, but really was probably to keep T-Rex from biting the shit out of its most vulnerable parts. And so there's a lot of interesting evidence and signs of that too. And then the other kind of famous thing with T-Rex and pathologies is that T-Rex, some of the most well-known skulls, including Sioux and Montana's T-Rex and a couple others, is that there are holes that go through the mandible, the denary. Mm-hmm. And it's hypothesized to be an avian respiratory kind of illness thing, but that too is debated. So not everybody buys that that is an infection from a specific disease and from a specific source. So again, it just really highlights, like, even with a pretty ample sample size, it doesn't necessarily mean that we understand exactly what's causing these injuries to be left over. And that is, you know, more shit to study.
Yeah.
One really interesting concept that I was introduced to last year, this is a funny story too, is that there's a lot of evidence that T-Rex fucked with Triceratops and ate Triceratops, like, and almost every museum where they're together, T-Rex is destroying this poor Triceratops, right? Like the new, relatively new Deep Time exhibit at the Smithsonian famously has the nation's T-Rex, which is the Wankel Rex, everyone, ripping the head off of a Triceratops in the display. And last year, I was helping out Dinosaur Ridge even before I started working there with interviewing some folks for their podcast, which is awesome, by the way. Family friendly. What an idea.
Not like us.
And I was interviewing Dr. Ali Nabavizadeh, who does a lot of comparative biology stuff. He is a ceratopsian expert, so he studies a lot of the horned dinosaurs. Just had this dope book come out, I think, yet last year, all about some really crazy cool illustrations. And one of the things that he brought up is he's like, I'm just so tired of every single thing being like Triceratops being like the butt of the joke. And his point was he thinks that Triceratops probably managed to do just as much damage to T-Rex, but probably did it to soft tissue. And probably like he relayed to me that it would be like the horns being used to go upward into like the belly, like the bowels of the T-Rex. And essentially like disembowel it and would have been a pretty proficient fighter against the T-Rex. But we don't see evidence for that, because if that was the case, it doesn't leave any record in the bone. And he just is, he actually made me come around on Triceratops. Yeah. Yeah. And right.
Doesn't give them a bone infection that lasts for weeks until they finally die. Just straight up disembowels T-Rex.
Yeah. Which is hot. Yeah. Go for it. Do it. Yeah. I mean, it would have been like literally hot. That would have been just like organs.
Gross.
Just...
Ew.
So that's
stabbing a T-Rex and coming back with a hat of entrails. That's disgusting.
Just like drawn and quartered T-Rex. It's fucking metal. Someone draw that. Oh, maybe not. That's kind of gross. Yeah, so that was the last disgusting thing that I have to say today. I will rest.
Awesome. Well, I have quite a bit more disgusting things to talk about, because I'm going to start talking about osteomyelitis, which is general bone infection. It can be caused by a lot of different things. And it specifically means infection of the bone. So it's often secondary. So it's not something that you just look at a bacteria and you get. The bacteria has to get into your system somehow. And frequently it has to get actually into the bone. So getting a bite mark is a good way to start osteomyelitis. Not necessarily the only way, probably the most common form of osteomyelitis, at least not outside of humans, is actinomycosis, which is caused by a very specific soil bacteria that then can invade the like gums and like the dental cavities of herbivores. So it causes a disease called lumpy jaw, which is a form of osteomyelitis that essentially... All osteomyelitis, the way that you diagnose it as being different from something else, is that basically when osteomyelitis gets bad enough, it infects the inside of the bone. And so as a result, you get pus buildup on the this is going to be really extra gross. You get pus buildup on the inside of your bone. This is also with lumpy jaw. The reason it's called lumpy jaw is because that pus puts severe pressure on the rest of your bone to remodel. So your periosteum, for example, will then go ahead and create more bone on the outside to compensate for the bone that is being eroded away on the inside. Oh. It doesn't necessarily compensate fast enough. So if you x-ray an animal that has osteomyelitis or person, you'll usually see that the density of bone decreases because it's like trying to outrace this form of pressure.
Whoa. And with,
yeah, right? Like it's like this swelling, nasty, like
it's a physics
cavity.
It's a physics problem of trying
it's
to
a physics problem. Yeah.
Continue to strengthen that bone, but can't because it's literally running out of, wow. Whew.
Yeah. And one of the characteristic signs on the outside of the bone is typically the periosteum will kind of lift up and start depositing bone somewhat erratically. So like your bone will be swelling, which is a pretty good sign, but also it has what's called, I've seen it called a filigree texture, like little lace basically.
Oh, fancy.
Because it's like lots and lots and lots of little tiny like rivulets and like, it's just basically this weird chunk of trying to lay down bone super fast and laying it down kind of erratically.
Wow.
But the most obvious sign is of course, sometimes that pus finds a way out and creates a hole. And that hole isn't just in your flesh. Like, it's not just pus leaking out of your cheek, which happens in lumpy jaw, actinomycosis. It's pus leaking out of your bone. So a really good way to see if an animal had osteomyelitis of any kind is you'll see a swollen bone. If you x-ray it, it's not as dense on the inside. Very frequently on the outside, you'll have like this weird filigree, lacy kind of texture. Sometimes it's sinusoidal, so it's got like little S shapes in it for some reason. And also there will be a big hole, which when I first started looking at oreodonts, I thought were bite marks.
Oh.
Yeah. So it can be a little bit difficult to tell the difference between a bite mark that is healing versus big old pus hole.
She said it here first.
Big, you want to know what the big old pus hole is called in a lot of this literature, Amy?
Well, what? No. Tell me.
It's one of your favorite words. It's going to ruin it.
Is it called promiscuous hole?
Nope. What's a hole that does it all?
Oh my God, it's a cloaca?
Yeah, it's called a cloaca.
It's a pus cloaca?
Yeah, aww. Cloaca for pus.
That makes it like cute.
Yeah. No, it doesn't. Which brings me to oreodonts. So oreodonts, if you haven't listened to the podcast, are the animal that I studied for my dissertation. And the research I'm going to talk about now is my research. Imagine something that looks kind of like a pig, but it's related to camels, but its head is really fucking big to its body size.
We might go into a bit this, like, it would have spit in my face. It would have been a spitter.
Ooh, I've never considered whether they would be spitters or not. I don't know. I don't know if they spit like llamas and alpacas do. That might just be a camelid thing. So yeah, I don't know if there's going to be a fossil record for that necessarily. So you can fill in the blanks in your own head. And the oreodont we're going to talk about today is a genus called Promericacurus. It does have lots of other names because oreodont taxonomy is insane. But most people call it Promericacurus. And
most
this one
people?
Really...
Okay, how many of us are there? Like 10? Are there 10 of us in the world?
The people who talk about oreodonts and don't just ignore them. Mostly.
And even out of them.
We'll call them Promericacurus. Yeah. So Promericacurus is one of the more pig-shaped oreodonts. It's got really short, stocky legs, really big head, kind of terrifying teeth, if I'm honest. Some pretty... Yeah. Big fangs. But the weirdest part about Promericacurus is its cheekbones. So if you look at the cheekbones of this animal, what are you laughing at? What is weirder than its cheeks?
It's just like a weird thing to be the weird part of a creature, you know? That's like not expected.
Yeah, most animals are like,
no. Who also has weird cheekbones, though, are entelodonts. And those are like a defining part of their weird hell pigness. Yeah.
Weird cheekbones isn't that weird in herbivores. So Promericacurus has really wide cheekbones. They go out really far from the sides of its heads, and then the back of them curl up and over. So it's got this weird, like, strange hook shape. We don't really 100% know what they were for, but I have some ideas which are related to pus in a very long, convoluted kind of series of events ways. But initially, when Promericacurus was being found and was being described, a lot of paleontologists in the 40s looked at each new kind of Promericacurus, and they noticed, that some of them had really wide cheekbones and some of them just had kind of wide cheekbones, that some of them had really long faces and some of them had kind of long faces. And a lot of that is probably sexual dimorphism. They're describing like the differences between females and males. Right. But one characteristic when I was first looking into oreodonts that stuck out was rugosity. So rugosity is kind of a catch-all term for, I don't know, it's kind of rough looking. And some species of oreodonts, of Promericacurus specifically, were being identified by this species is more rugose. It has weirder cheekbones than the other one does. So I wanted to look at this, obviously, and so I went to a bunch of different museums and I was looking at the rugosity, and I noticed that it looked quite a lot like bite marks. There were big holes in these cheekbones. Some of them have straight up chunks that have been taken out of the cheekbone and the bone has healed around it. So it's like you don't see the spongy bone because the bone has healed a divot in the cheekbone, like a quarter-sized divot. Ooh, in a cheekbone.
It's just battle wounds. Yeah.
Battle wounds. Yeah. And these are pretty extensively concentrated on the cheekbones. There's not really a lot of, there's a couple bite marks and a couple of holes and a little bit of rugosity in other places, but 90% of these injuries are directly on these giant fucking cheekbones. And it turns out most of the things that I saw and thought were bite marks were in fact not bite marks. They are probably pus cloacas.
Oh, face pus holes.
Yeah. Why don't you describe for the audience what you see there?
I appreciate so much your scale bar. And it's weird fucking nose. Yeah. So I'm looking at a beautiful Promerica Caris skull. Mm-hmm. It's got quite the, is that a sagittal crest? Is that what you'd call that?
Sagittal crest. They have a very big sagittal crest. They were good at biting.
They were pronounced. And it's got big ass fangs. It's got very wide. Oh, like honestly, its cheekbones remind me of a human pelvis, right? Like a bowl shape kind of. It's kind of like that. Like that looks like an ilium in a lot of ways. And then on that zygomatic or jugal, whatever part that is, there's like this pea-sized hole that looks like
you got a scale bar. How big is it?
It's about 1 centimeter long, like in diameter there. And it looks like it's trying to like gauge its cheekbones or something like that. But it looks like you put it on there so you could like put this on like a necklace and you could string it on a chain.
Yeah. So it's got about a centimeter wide hole. And below it, you can see kind of like the cheekbone has puffed up a little bit. So that's a very clear sign of osteomyelitis. There was infection inside of that cheekbone.
Question on that then. Mm-hmm. So you're saying, okay, I thought these were bite marks. Now I realize that they're pus drainage routes. Could they be both? Is there a chance that the pus looks for the path of least resistance?
Yeah. So the question is, how does the bacteria get into the body? And why is it specifically going for the cheekbones? So when I looked at, I think I had like 50 or 60 Promerica caris skulls, and I wanted to only use the ones that had cheekbones because that was the ones that we were interested in, is looking at their cheekbones. But of the 50 or 60 Promerica caris that had cheekbones, 40% of them had some sort of filigree texture, hole, chunks missing, really big bulbous inflated bone, all on their cheekbones. So something is biting them to cause this inflammation. And it is really extensive. I don't know if that picture has shown up yet.
It did.
Yeah, but that's the underside of the cheekbone. That thing was huge. It was like, I don't know, like 3 centimeters wide because it was so inflated. And it has multiple pus drainage marks because, of course, it's not always just one. And the reason that I concluded that these were pus drainage marks and not necessarily bite marks is kind of complex. So when you have a skull get bitten, if it has a chance to heal before death, you're going to get a very different signature than if it just dies, right? So if an oreodont gets bit and it dies pretty quickly, you're going to have a fairly clean puncture. You'll often have what's called green bone fracturing, where you'll get like conchoidal fractures around the hole. And you won't have signs of bone remodeling. It won't have smoothed itself out. You won't have additional pits or anything. But if it is healed, you will have a hole that has like some degree of like smoothing over. What you won't have is big puffy bone and filigree texture that is spreading out, you know, 5 centimeters away from the hole. If you do have that, that's probably a good indication that it is actually an infection, because that's the bone overreacting, right? That would be an overreaction.
I can relate.
But I strongly suspect that a lot of these were actually caused by bite marks. I don't know that necessarily the holes that we see are bite marks themselves that have been co-opted into becoming pus drainages. They're not bite marks that became cloacas necessarily, but it's very hard to get a bone infection. It's not very common in people. It's weirdly common in sheep, but that's one specific type. But osteomyelitis as a general thing is not super common. So basically my theory after looking at all of these different animals with all of these different injuries is I suspect that they were biting each other and it was causing these massive face infections, and that it was probably some sort of really poorly planned dominance display. If you can bite your friend's face and make him injured and pussy, he doesn't really have a whole lot of time or biological energy to concentrate on making sperm or making time.
Or to like get in your way while you're eating all those other dead oreodonts.
But when you think about it, 40% is really fucking high. Like that is
that's a lot
of these animals that are actively sick at the time of death.
And you said, though, when you were looking at modern stuff, like the bighorn sheep and whatnot, there were pretty high percentages with that. So, you know, my next question, which is related, I know part of this answer, but, you know, we talk a lot about sheep, pigs, and camels with Oriodonts. I know that camels do a lot of biting, right? I think you've told me that. Are they all biters? Are these all, like, kinky freaks?
I mean, I don't know what a camel really gets up to in its spare time. Sheep definitely are not biters. Sheep are head butters. We have had sheep that are nippers, but it's only if you're offering them food. It's not like they're biting as a form of defense. Camels definitely do bite each other and people, and they have pretty nasty fangs. I have not seen bone infection in any of the modern orc fossil camel skulls that I've looked at.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. And I also don't see any animal in the modern record that has cheekbones like this. Even if you look at things like hippos, which do have pretty wide cheekbones, their cheekbones are situated differently so that they can drop their jaw open all the way. These cheekbones don't seem to have improved the bite strength at all. And unlike in hippos, where the jaws kind of move outwards a little bit with the expanding cheekbones, so like everything is getting wider if you're a hippo. With these guys, only the zygomatic arches get wider. The jaw itself doesn't necessarily seem to expand. So you have this really obvious like characteristic about this organism. It's got bite. There were some actual bite marks, but most of these are like bite marks and infections. So for me, that says something about like, this is maybe like antlers, essentially. This is a section of the body that has been expanded for some reason related to impressing others. But I also don't. I don't know, like 40% is a really high percentage. The other thing to keep in mind is that not all Oriodonts die with their zygomatic arches. So we might just be looking at males, for example. If females didn't have as big or as thick of zygomatic arches, maybe their zygomatic arches broke. Maybe if you don't have bone infection that causes this weird rapid growth, your zygomatic arches remain relatively small and they are more likely to break. So part of the reason that we're seeing 40% with these infections might not mean that 40% of Oriodonts were running around like zombies with pus draining down their faces. It might just mean that the conditions of fossilization tended to prefer those because they have more bone that you'd have to get rid of.
That's disgusting.
It's disgusting.
Right. And then also the fact that these are like the chonkiest of the Oriodonts. So that's going to help with some taphonomic stuff too, because they're going to just be like more like, you know, more robust.
Yes.
And maybe they could withstand all the preservation processes better because they were the biggest of the bigs.
Yes.
And disgusting. Disgusting. Yes. Or they were just like really into it. They were like, I like it when my face is puffy.
Yeah.
And full of pus.
If really you have half of your population is walking around at any time with pus face, that seems like a recipe for disaster. And yes, they are extinct, but so are a lot of other Oriodonts that didn't have super obvious bone infections all of the time. So I think that probably what we have in Oriodonts is a combination of those nice big cheekbones make them attractive to other things, but are also a convenient target. And if you get bit, that causes bone infection. And if you get bone infection, your bone is stronger for fossilization purposes. You are miserable. Yeah. This would not have been pleasant. Weirdly, have not found a single Oriodont with actinomycosis.
Oh, wait. And what would that look like?
Lumpy jaw. And it's only usually in the jaw. Sometimes I think I've seen it a little bit in the upper, but usually it's in the mandible. And I have not seen that in any Oriodonts.
Huh. They just did it this way. Their lumpy jaw was lumpy cheeks.
It might
also
be that they were browsers more than they were grazers. And actinomycosis is a soil organism. So maybe they were just able to avoid it. But yeah, no cavities either.
Wow. You know, wow. Wild. That's
it's almost
impressive.
Like they were really healthy other than their pus faces.
Oh. Maybe you're just catching them in their teenage years. And these are just their like, you know, bone acne.
Well, we did find several juveniles that had these marks. So it's not something that is exclusively limited to really big and wide skulls, which we would assume were male. It does seem
there
to
you go.
Be
right. Okay.
Impacting kids as well. So maybe there's some little shithead teenagers that were getting in on this action as well.
Right. Well, that sounds about right. Boneheads, pus heads.
So yeah, that's Oriodonts. I still need to finish writing up that paper, but there were at least quite a few pus-filled, leaky-faced Orionauts running around in the world when Primary Cacurus was alive. And if you want to see some of them, not the living ones, obviously, they're dead. The Carnegie Museum has some really beautiful displays, and one of them includes three big Primary Cacurus that died together in a sandstorm, and they're cuddling, which is really cute and sad. Aww. Yeah. And they have a little bit of rugosity, but they also have quite a lot of arthritis, actually. So they were like older gentlemen in the sandstorm.
Or just like the old ladies just spooning.
I think these ones were dudes. They have pretty big, wide zygomatic arches, but maybe they were ladies. We don't know. It's kind of, it's pretty much impossible, actually, to tell whether they were actually female or male. Maybe there was some non-sex related reason for getting your cheekbones that big.
I dare to dream. I can just, it was for like handles, but they didn't have hands. It doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, they didn't have hands. They had hooves.
Yeah. Oh, God, that's gross. Yeah, I know when I've handled a few of these specimens that I've always been like envisioning what their head would have really looked like, you know, 30 million years ago or whatever. And that kind of grosses me out. I don't get grossed out by a lot, but the idea of holding like a pus-filled bone is not as I like, give me copper lights all day, every day, but pus filled bones. That's gross. It's just like a, you know, Cadbury egg from hell. It's just disgusting.
Oh my God, Amy. Oh my God.
It's just, I wonder what's inside. Oh, I know. Oh, it's pus. Oh,
the cream.
Oh. Ta-da.
Yeah, so not a species level characteristic. In fact, if you look at a bunch of Orionauts from the same location at the same time, you're gonna have a variety, some that have pus faces, some that do not, because this is definitely paleopathology. It's not, some of them had rough bone and some of them didn't.
Right, it is not a sign of different ancestry. It is, it could happen to, it could happen to any of us.
Yeah.
I'm gonna bite someone's cheekbone.
Yeah, so that's paleopus is, it's good to keep in mind that probably a lot of other Orionauts did have injuries. They just didn't necessarily get bone infections. And that even though we see 40% that have bone infections, that doesn't necessarily mean 40% at any given time were just hanging out, leaking pus, trying to impress the ladies. Like, it probably was some sort of other signature that is preserving more than other things.
So thank you for sharing the Orionaut absurdities of pussy. Nope, I wasn't going to say pussy this episode.
We really cannot say pussy, because deciding how to spell that is just not going to fly.
Nope.
It's going to be something totally different.
Ba-ba-ba. Thanks, all.